from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Fortan. Today on the show, I have a very special guest. It turns out that during my research phase, I was trying to look into Native American folklore, and I was way out of my depth. So what I decided to do was actually interview someone who could talk to us about it, because I have lots of questions, and they're related to some of the research that I'm doing. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my guest. He's a professor of anthropology at Penn State. He's also the author of Archaeology of North America, which is apparently the seminal book if you are interested in the subject. His name is Dean R. Snow. Dean, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, you know, you're kind of a lifesaver here, because I have to tell you, my initial experience when trying to do research on this was that it was very difficult for me to be able to distinguish from fact and from a kind of mythologizing of history. Is that a fair analysis of the scene, in a sense?
Well, I think that's a fair analysis of almost anything historical, because the farther in the past it is, the more it tends to become mythologized.
Right. There seems to be almost like an instinct that people have to want to mythologize. Is it to aggrandize history, or is it just because it's tied into religious folklore?
I think it's to neaten it up a bit. I mean, look how we've mythologized John Kennedy, and he was a president who was alive in my lifetime, but there's a fair amount of myth surrounding him already.
Right, it's true. The name of his administration, Camelot, comes from a musical that he was fond of.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all of a sudden they just ran with it.
Yeah, it was a terrific musical at the time, so that, you know, it was something that people could really identify with when they started referring to it as Camelot.
I suppose, like, if you look at even just as far back as some of our first stories of Gilgamesh and Enkidu, I mean, Gilgamesh is probably a real guy that is just very mythologized.
Right, yeah. And that real guy got transformed by all kinds of traditions over the course of time, too. I had a professor at the University of Minnesota many years ago who had one of his favorite lectures talking about Gilgamesh, trying to figure out where the names of these various heroes came from. And one of the heroes turned out to have a name that in some obscure language in the Middle East meant he who will be saved or something of that sort. And the flood myth surrounds all these guys. I mean, you see these themes popping up over and over again. And the names change, but mainly because the languages that various people spoke are different.
Well, this is why I wanted to have you on the show, because I will admit to not having a very strong familiarity with native mythology. I tend to be more specialized in Mesopotamian, but that's, you know, entirely because of my field of research and expertise focuses on, you know, say, Judaic history. So my familiarity is not with, say, the place geographically where I live. So I had a few questions about it, especially because there are so many parts of the myth that seem to kind of coincide with a lot of other religious traditions. And that's sort of like where I wanted to see what are the differences and what are the similarities there. And you seem to have a somewhat of a familiarity with both. So I'm kind of like, I lucked out, I'm guessing.
I have a little familiarity. What I know best is what you called me about. So I don't really know that much about the Mesopotamian material.
Well, just enough to know kind of a few basics, because we're not going to get, you know, I don't think we can cover more than a few basics, because that's, you know, like, that's probably outside my skill range itself. Anyways, my first question was, well, when it came to researching the character of the great peacemaker, and his name again, I'll let you pronounce, what is his name in?
Well, his name is, it's pronounced Daganoweda, but the Iroquois are sensitive about uttering the name. So it's a bit like, you see this in the Middle East as well. You shouldn't say the name of the divine one, but it was Daganoweda.
Right. And the name something means along the lines of someone who shall not be named this again, kind of a thing. Isn't that what
it is? Well, it might. part of the problem here is that there are a lot of names that have come down, and the names have been around for so long that the etymology is very difficult to reconstruct. They've morphed into long, for us, tongue twister names, but they've been alive and well for so long that the languages that coined them can no longer be examined closely enough to figure out what they mean precisely in every case.
So we're very much stuck in terms of, like, is there any way for us to be able to uncover this more? Do you see this improving over time? Like, are there more studies that can be done, grammatical analysis that?
Well, yeah, the linguists have been working on this, and it's kind of an interesting parlor game. You can do this with English words too, you know, that come out of Anglo-Saxon. And you can sit around and try to figure out, well, what was the original meaning of that word? It probably had some sort of mundane meaning at the beginning, but it's hard to figure that out now. Linguists can do that.
Why do they have this attitude?
Because it doesn't really matter what the etymological origins of Daganoweda might have been. What's really important about it is the name and how it's used today. I guess that would be their argument.
I suppose so. And I guess this is why we, you know, people specialize in different areas. But I think that at least understanding what the words means give you an insight into the people at, you know, of the time.
Well, it might. Does knowing what the etymological roots of Yahweh are, would knowing that help us really understand ancient Jewish religion? Not so sure.
Well, I could make an argument that you could, especially when you consider the fact that Yahweh is one of the earlier Akkadian gods, or I think it's Assyrian gods, and that, you know, Yahweh very much represents a very warlike, very harsh personification of God, which is different from the Elohim and the Jehovah, and these represent like different schools of thought. So I would make that argument, saying like absolutely, because those are influenced by the culture that predates it.
But do we know what Yahweh meant in an everyday sort of way?
At which time? At the time that
it was initially coined or initially applied.
Well, piecing together that puzzle is probably pretty massive, but I still think that there's something to be gained from it. Maybe it's like the assumption where I'm wrong, but at the very least, mine is at least, let's push it further. Let's try to improve our knowledge. It can only help. The one that shall not be named. Now, his legend, it pops around, it seems, the 15th century. Is this right? Is this when it first makes its appearance?
Well, 15th and 16th. It's conceivable that this got going as early as the late 15th century, but more likely it's a 16th century phenomenon.
Is it possible, because I was reading that this coincides very closely to when Samuel de Champlain was around. Like,
he was around early 17th century, yeah.
Well, I mean, at least in terms of what eventually evolved into the myth of the Great Peace, does the legend as it exists now invariably suffer from that kind of influence? Like, because that was the part where I was having problems identifying, like, is the character really born of a virgin before that influence, before the Western influence?
I'm not sure about that. Various other people have explored that, and frankly, I don't know what the answer is. But you could have Christian influences on this that came along later. There are many different versions of that whole early mythological cycle, and it sort of depends upon which one you latch onto. I think probably the most exhaustive treatment of it was done by a scholar named Hani Woodbury, and she did a terrific job with one version of the peacemaker legend. But there are others. And you may well find that some of them are more influenced by Christianity than others.
Well, it was also the problem also lies in the fact that if a person that's looking at it and trying to determine, was it influenced by Christianity, does that not itself kind of perhaps poison the research where the parts that were not influenced by Christianity might be attributed to it, where really there's more of a kind of similarity across all narratives that we just see, like in Lord Raglan's The Hero. And that's kind of where I am, where I cannot determine the difference. And even the people that tell me, well, it's Christian influence, I'm like, did you see it from a Christian eye? And were you judging it based on that, or were you able to distinguish the parts that were really original and not influenced by it? So that was my biggest kind of quandary here. I wasn't able to answer that question in any way.
you know, I don't think you should feel badly about that, because I think that's the most fundamental problem we have with this kind of analysis. And people face this all the time. Are you looking at something that came down into Christianity from something much older that is shared across all of Eurasia and then ultimately into North America? That's possible. You might see a trait in a legend like this that is so fundamentally human that you would expect to find it everywhere. But then people get into the game of sort of comparing recent cases and saying, well, this influenced that one in the, I don't care, 10th century AD, something along those lines. But in fact, what you really are seeing is something that speaks to a more kind of fundamental human characteristic. And I think that problem isn't just yours. That plagues all of this kind of research.
It's comforting to know that I'm not crazy here, or at least my research hasn't failed me entirely, if this question is legitimate. But the other part, too, that I was very curious about, not just this supposed virginity of his birth, but also there's a part where the grandmother, in at least one variation of the story, tries to drown him. Part of it is also because the mother refuses to say who the father is. Now, is this a common practice that would happen just at the time if there was undetermined patronage? Were babies likely to, just get drowned or something like that? Was that a cultural practice of some kind?
Well, it was sometimes the case that twins were born, one would be allowed to die. And there were certainly circumstances when children didn't survive because they were born at a really bad time of the year, and it was just simply not possible to keep them going through the cold months or something along those lines. And so you do get these stories occasionally about infanticide. It's the kind of story that gets told because it's something that people worry about. It's like the monster stories. It goes to the heart of what people are really concerned about.
Right, a relative killing a baby when, a trusted relative doing this.
Yeah.
That is nightmarish.
Yeah. And that might be the source of it. You know, it may be, certainly gives the story some punch, and that might be why it's there. It's the boogeyman phenomenon, possibly.
And when we talk about the various, the intersection between different myths and what influences what, I think also maybe one way we could look at it is say, well, if there's an influence there, it means that there's some parts of the story that are so common and shared that we just adapt them. They just fit so naturally into those narratives. That for me seems to indicate like we have, our stories are similar and they may trace our own development, which is also why I wondered if at the time of the legend and particularly its political consequences, because when you look at, say, the constitution that is said to come from the meat of all of these different clan chiefs, that this mythical character manages to agree to all meat after they're warring. Is this a political move because of external pressures from, an external force now, a foreign external force that's powerful and a threat? Do the tribes unite because of that, or was it something that was slowly building because they were trying to change the foundation of their own societies?
Well, there was certainly external threat to each of these communities, and I would argue that that preceded the arrival of Europeans. What's interesting to me about this is they found a way to redirect hostility away from each other, the five founding nations of the Haudenosaunee. But in doing so, they, in effect, redirected that hostility outside the group. So that's what confederacies do.
They create in-groupness, right?
Well, that's right. And then they promise, well, we won't fight each other anymore. But now that I think about it, what do you guys think of maybe pooling our resources and going after this other group that none of us like very much? And that's exactly what happened. The Iroquois, or the Haudenosaunee, became a very strong force. They no longer went after each other. The infighting stopped within the Confederation, but they redirected their efforts against the Huron, the Catawbas, the Susquehannocks, anybody else that they didn't think much of for one reason or another.
This would explain probably why the Huron started to ally themselves with the French, I guess?
Well, yeah, the Huron retreated from the heart of eastern Ontario. They retreated to the area right up just to the east of Lake Huron and concentrated there. Prior to the late 16th century, they had been much more widely scattered and down in the direction of the Trent Valley and over towards Montreal. So their reaction was to pull back physically and to move into this kind of refuge area up around Lake Simcoe, that area. And after that, of course, they had a lot of engagements with the Iroquois down in the New York, Haudenosaunee or Iroquois. A lot of warfare went on on there between these two confederations. But in the case of the Huron, the confederation actually relocated, and the elements of that, the nations that made up that confederacy, all packed themselves together in that small area just to the east of Lake Huron.
I understand that you were also doing epidemiological studies about the native populations and the spread of disease. And I kind of wondered, at least within the confederacy, the design of the longhouse, was this one of the ways that perhaps the diseases spread more than they would have in a differently designed society? Was there something inherent about the way their societies were structured that made them more vulnerable to disease?
Well, I think their settlement pattern did make them a bit more vulnerable to all these diseases. Scarlet fever, for example, got loose in one of the Huron villages. There's the Jesuit relations have a good record of this. And what was interesting to the Jesuits was that some longhouses, everybody got sick, and in other longhouses, nobody got sick. Well, it turns out that the way scarlet fever transmits is through food. And if you're eating out of a communal pot and the pot gets infected, then everybody's going to get sick. Well, they didn't know what the disease vector was for scarlet fever. They didn't realize that, you know, it was in the pot simmering over the fire. So there really wasn't much they could do to stop it. Also, it's the case that when things like influenza got loose or measles, these longhouse villages were so tightly packed and everybody's living so close together that the odds that people would get sick if there was somebody sick in their midst were, you know, it was almost 100% certainty. And so then it was simply a matter of how many would survive the illness. In the case of smallpox, the mortality is about 60%. And the morbidity rate was basically 100% in these villages. Once smallpox was in there, everybody got it.
Right. Well, that seems to kind of indicate what I was talking about. Like just an unfortunate design that would have, like were it not even for the European diseases, if any inborn disease that they would have had, could have had such a devastating effect because of the structure that they had sort of taken. That's sort of like my analysis, at least from what I was looking at. Like, well, it has some advantages, at least communally, but the disadvantages are there doesn't seem to be a good way to quarantine. Like quarantine doesn't even seem like it's a concept. And I mean, without quarantine, you have problems.
Well, and quarantine works best if you've got a disease that is detectable before the person really becomes infectious. In the case of smallpox, I mean, another insidious aspect of that disease is that people who look very healthy may be in the early stage of the smallpox, and 2 or 3 days, they will be able to transmit the disease to others around them, but not show any symptoms of it themselves. And so nobody's aware that this guy that just came into the village is carrying a disease that will spread to everybody. And this happened over and over again. And there's, in fact, one account of a Mohawk village where somebody arrived from the Andaste area down in Pennsylvania. And the guy was fine, but he came down sick after he had been there for a couple of days. And sure enough, by that time, he had transmitted the disease to all those around him. And then it just spread like wildfire through the whole village.
Well, one of the things that I've kind of been curious about, just to take a step way back, is trying to determine the pattern of the kind of civilizing factor, ways that societies will go and transform from, say, hunter-gatherer to agricultural. But the one thing that I've kind of don't understand is that if you look at the pattern of migration of people after the land barrier and the ice age, it seems that it first, like the civilizing, or at least the advancement of civilization, comes first from the very, very tropical areas, and then only slowly moves upwards. Is the narrowness of that tropical area in North America one of the reasons for its slower, much, much less rapid development and spread?
Well, that's a point that Jared Diamond makes in his Guns, Germs, and Steel book. He points out that Eurasia is elongated east-west, and that means that people can move huge distances without leaving basically the same environment. Yeah. If they're in the temperate zone, they can stay in the temperate zone all the way across. Whereas the Americas tend to be oriented north-south. And so any long-distance movement almost certainly will take you into a different growing zone, for example. So, you know, it's no surprise, I suppose, that the cultigens, the domesticated crops that are really successful in modern times tend to originate in fairly warm regions of the world and then spread northward as they are made to adapt through selective breeding to more temperate environments. So that's what happened in North America. When crops were domesticated in Mesoamerica, they gradually spread northward and people picked them up and were able to then live in larger communities and more permanent communities. So sedentary life became possible because of food production.
Let's imagine, for instance, though, that the Europeans never land in North America, at least not for another, say, 300 years.
Okay.
In that sort of landscape, what were we starting to see develop before there was kind of that influence, that massive change? What was starting to happen?
Well, we had cities. We had lots of cities in what is now Mexico. We had a major city across the river from what is now St. Louis. And there were other smaller cities or big towns scattered around the eastern woodlands. We had fairly large settlements in the American Southwest. Now, the big city that I just referred to opposite St. Louis was abandoned by, well, before Columbus arrived. So they were going through their own cycles of rise and fall, and we probably would have seen that continue to play out. We would have seen other large cities arise, and then the circumstances turn against them, and they would be abandoned. But this could have gone on for a long time, and we could have seen a continuing growth of civilized life in North America. But all of it, of course, got short-circuited by the arrival of Europeans.
Right. I suppose that's the reason that I find it a little bit, well, not a little bit, very tragic here, is also that this was a good example of just seeing the play of civilizations, because just the nature, if Jared Diamond is correct, and I think he is, then it would just mean that, like, the process would have just been slowed down. So you were just looking through the lens and say, here's 1,000 years back, just because this process, the use of agriculture and the domestication, the two most important factors in order to be able to achieve a new playing field, entirely different, with all kinds of new challenges, but also new opportunities. And that just plays out again and again and again. And there's almost something like, I'm curious about the universal aspects of it, the parts that just are all the same, because that at least tells us not only about ourselves, but if we want to craft a future for ourselves, what I call future crafting, then we have to know which parts are just actually inherent and design them accordingly. So all aspects of our lives, like, it should be, you know, we should take the same approach with computers. We design computers for humans because that's what services them. And I'm like, and we understand what the needs are because, it tries to service those needs. So identifying those elements means that we identify the needs in ourselves. And I'm like, what, in at least from your ability to have really just delved into a field of study that is still, you know, it's not as large as many of the others. What would you say are kinds of the really interesting factors that seem different, like their different approach that seemed novel, and it would have been interesting to see where that would have gone.
I think the principal one for the American Indians that would, I mean, be wonderful to see how this might have played out otherwise, is the lack of domesticated animals here in the Americas. They had llamas in South America, but let's face it, you can't do much with a llama. You can't pull wagons with llamas. You can't get them to pull plows. You can't ride them. Their ability to serve as domesticated beasts of burden is very limited. On the other hand, if you look at the old world, you've got two or three different kinds of very large bovines that can haul huge loads on wagons or just on their backs. They had horses in the old world. None of that was available over here. And yet they had managed to domesticate crops like maize that turns out to be this remarkable plant, because you can plant it and get it to grow and produce a huge amount of grain with just hand techniques. You don't need to be able to plow the ground first.
It's a grass, right?
It's basically a grass. But a grass that was capable of growing to the huge proportions that we see now today, you know, a cob of corn like you have in August, you know, for dinner that's an enormous plant with a huge amount of edible material on it. And we've never seen other grasses like barley and wheat get elaborated to that kind of size. But it turns out to have been fortuitous for the American Indians, because they're able to grow this thing and use it as a staple without domesticated animals. Now, the lack of domesticated animals means, too, that they didn't have the kind of transportation that they had in Europe and Asia and Africa.
Or war devices.
Exactly. So how would that have played out in the absence of animal domesticates that could serve not just for meat and providing fiber, but also for transportation? How would things have played out in the Americas over time as they continued to evolve without what you might consider to be some of the key ingredients of old world civilization?
True. But although I do think that they would have needed a kind of secondary crop of some kind, because the problem with maize is that it's a lot of, I don't want to say empty calories, but you know, you've got the problem that we have here where it's it makes us fat, diabetic, and you know, the nutritional value isn't quite as high as, say, wheat.
It turns out that it's much more successful if it's mixed with beans. And so, I mean, that was another part of this puzzle that was so important to them. By growing the beans and the corn together and then eating the beans and the corn together, they got some advantages they wouldn't have had with either of them alone.
Ah, I see. So, but that's more, again, from sort of the Mesoamerican area, right, where they were cultivating beans. Were they cultivating
right.
beans up north, or had they just the maize? Were they just starting with that one?
Maize got here first, and then beans followed later. And they, by the time of Columbus, the maize and beans were both a major part of the diet, along with squash. Those were the three biggies.
And that reached, how far up did agriculture really reach in North America? Where was that line where all of a sudden you see again more hunter-gatherers? It doesn't seem to be like, again, the beast of burden to be able to till difficult land.
In the Midwest, it was the upper Great Lakes. And here in the East, it was the southern edge of the Canadian Shield.
And after that, it's just hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, right. You get a little bit past Peterborough, Ontario, and your chances of having a successful harvest as a farmer aren't very good.
Well, you could harvest mosquitoes. There seems to be plenty of them.
Yeah, right. Black flies.
Right, but probably plenty of protein in them, too.
Well, you know, the farther you go down the food chain, the more there is.
I suppose, though, that the problem of harvesting these kinds of bugs is that they're probably hard to get a hold of, right? Like, you can't just build an easy enclave for that.
Yeah, and it's just a continuation of another argument having to do with the, you know, small mammals. There's more meat running around in the form of mice in the woods than there is in the form of deer. But the deer are bigger and easier to catch. But the mice are hard to harvest.
Well, not unless you have a thresher.
Well, you'd have to have, you know, some way of keeping them penned up, I suppose, and rounding them up. You could have your mouse harvest in the fall if you had the right equipment, I suppose.
Well, I think, though, that I'm trying to remember what insane number of them die, though, from just actual agriculture. If we had a way to actually separate the meat, that's the problem. You can't. It probably just gets all mixed up in there. I'm like, yeah, hey, vegetarians, I got news for you. It's really difficult to separate lots of these different compounds. Things have a way of interacting quite a bit. It's like, what's in your food? You don't want to know. You do not want to know. Now, the legend, let's go back to talk about the legend of the Great Peacemaker. So if I'm trying to understand this correctly, these five previously warring tribes, now, are these tribes themselves hunter-gatherer, or do they have some...
They're settled village farmers.
So they're now at the stage where they're sedentary, and now they have the city states, and they're rising up armies and attacking each other.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them city states. They didn't have state government organization. They were at best small chiefdoms.
How big would they typically get? Like, what's the populations?
My research indicates that the a village became politically and socially unstable above about 2,000 people. So what would happen is they would split, and two villages be formed out of what had been one. Simply because there were too many negative feedback loops, bad dynamics in a village with more than 2,000-3,000 people.
Was the problem also that they didn't have a written language in order to be able to enable a bureaucracy? Was that their first challenge?
Well, you can have bureaucracies without a written language, but it is increasingly difficult, and that might have been. You can make the argument that that was part of the difficulty of keeping a larger community together.
But as far as we know, like, the population numbers were still fairly high. I think I remember somewhere reading that 20 million natives had died from disease. So clearly there were a lot of them.
Well, there weren't 20 million.
There weren't 20 million. That number's inflated?
Yeah. The reason I got into the paleodemography business to begin with was that back in the 70s and early 80s, there were these what I thought were outrageous claims for the size of the population of North America prior to Columbus. And the problem was that it got into a kind of of a one-upsmanship game where it became popular to claim ever larger numbers for the sizes of Native American nations in North America. So the way in which you trumped the other guy was to come up with a larger estimate than he had come up with. And it's sort of like the archaeological game where you're always trying to find the oldest whatever. And so, you know, in this case, back in the 70s, the game came to be played by people who kept coming up with ever larger estimates, you know, and it got to the point rather quickly where it was fairly clear, just if you just had a cursory understanding of what the archaeology of the continent looked like, there wasn't any place to put 20 million people alive all at the same time in what are now the United States and Canada. It just didn't make any sense. And so I thought, well, all right, if I'm going to make the counter argument, I better find ways in which to measure population through archaeological means in a convincing way. And so that was the origin of the Mohawk Valley Project that took me about, well, over a decade to conclude. But we were able to demonstrate that at least in the case of the Mohawks, we didn't have a really huge number of people there before Columbus, which was the argument that a couple of scholars were making. Every time you would say, well, you know, in 1610, there were 5,000 people living in this river valley, they would say, ah, yes, but that's only 5% of what was originally there before Columbus. And so then you get this multiplier effect. And frankly, we just couldn't see how you could possibly imagine that there were that many people in a valley of that size in 1492. So we went at it in a very systematic way.
So I guess that it was the problem I was having before, where there are certain kind of mythologizing and even political axes that are being ground, trying to sort of like, you know, manipulate that the past to make it fit your narrative.
Sure, you got it. That's exactly what happens.
I guess it paints the American, the, you know, like the European settlers as the ultimate evil, dark side that everybody wants if you want to make a very popular narrative, correct?
Yeah. Well, that was what was going on at the time. Of course, 100 years earlier, people were painting just the opposite narrative. In the 19th century, people were bending over backwards to minimize the role of American Indians prior to Columbus. You know, because the any other view interfered with their campaign to dispossess the American Indians of the landscape that they were living on.
Disenfranchise them. Yeah. To do that, you must first diminish them.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And that was what was going on in the 19th century. And by the middle of the 20th century, that had all reversed.
I suppose there came a time where people started to realize the real cost and impact of what their ancestors had done. Be like, oh, well, this land that I have, where did I get this, Grandpa? Well, we killed a whole bunch of people for it. Oh, that doesn't seem right. So I suppose, you know, we have that natural reaction to try to accept our culpability, but maybe in doing that, we forget our scholarship, right?
Well, yeah, and I think that it's less a problem even today in some countries than in others. But if you go to some countries in the developed world, you'll find this, the use of history and or historiography and archaeology in the service of whatever the current agenda is politically. You don't find that so much in the U.S. and Canada. But for those of us that live in one or another of these two countries, it's often not apparent to us that this is kind of an ideal situation that doesn't necessarily obtain in other countries around the world. And we certainly saw it in the Soviet Union back in the days when it still existed, the manipulation of history and archaeology to advance the political narrative that was popular and current at the time.
Well, I think the most blatant example I can remember of were Nazi archaeologists that were defacing certain tombs and archaeological sites to try to bolster their claim of having existed for like 1,000 years. And you're just like, oh, wow.
Sure.
That's all kinds of wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Nazis really were very good at that, rewriting history for their purposes.
Well, I think that's part of, you know, we talk about civilizations developing and they have certain characteristics. And we find ourselves, unfortunately, like everyone else, living in history and having to judge ours and trying to think about, well, what are the parts that we've improved on? What are the ways that we're just doing a lot better? And that we can pat ourselves on the back and then say, okay, well, what else what else now are we doing that's just still very wrong? The parts that we have to shed, because I think that it was Stephen Pinker who said that history is a foreign country. I'm not quite sure who said it, but it made so much sense when I heard that. You know, history is a foreign country, but it's also, you know, the histories of cultures. We've seen the spectrum pretty much from Stone Age to today on here on Earth. It's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it.
Yeah.
So we have all ranges of civilization leading up to right now. So I think that we do, it's probably unpopular for people to do this, but we do have to critically analyze these developments and see what parts lead to a kind of improvement and which parts don't.
Oh, we have to be honest with ourselves in order to do that effectively, and that's the hard part, I guess.
Yeah, the self-introspection that no one's ever going to be good at. The key we found is to criticize one another. That's what we found, yeah. Right? That's what works?
Yeah.
Spot the flaws in somebody else's argument, but never your own.
Right.
But we call that the scientific method, no?
Yeah, well, that's how we sort it all out.
We battle each other out. Try to kick each other in the intellectual nuts.
It is possible to attack another person's idea without attacking that person. And I think that good scientists do that routinely. They don't take it personally, and they don't attack personally. But I have seen this in other fields, particularly in the field of history. I've seen historians go after each other in a very personal way, not going after each other's ideas so much as going after each other. And the problem with that is that if somebody's thesis fails and the person who put that thesis forward fails at the same time, this is a pretty high cost. Ruined reputations and people being fired from their jobs is a very costly way to advance the field. I like it much better if ideas die, but the people who propounded, came up with them don't.
Well, I think the problem, though, and this must be a thing that is true of history, is that we like to entangle other parts of our lives in it that have no business being there. And I think major among those is religion. This is a major problem for history. I'm writing a book currently called Bible Stories, and it's a rather irreverent reading of the Bible. But I also want to be as accurate as I possibly can. I have sections where I just try to break down the history and give people a bit of a background. They're like, why is this book like this? Why, who wrote it? But one of the huge issues that I have is being able to find trustworthy historians that don't have that religious axe to grind, particularly when you're dealing with issues of Israel and Palestine. It is a nightmare. It is a nightmare. So really being able to get to the good science of it is just sort of cutting through all this politics and hopefully finding the serious people at the end of the day that refuse to let that poison their work. But it's very difficult, it seems.
Doing archaeology in Israel or the surrounding countries is really very difficult because of what you've just described. People are always going to want to find proof that something that's in the book is real. And so that becomes the objective. The problem is that archaeology doesn't operate well that way. It doesn't exist just to enlighten or illustrate something we think we already know from a written source. And to use it that way, in effect, sells it short. But that's a serious problem in Middle Eastern archaeology.
Right. I mean, just a classic example is that I was trying to look at the Bible, again, from a very different perspective of saying, well, clearly the part where there's the diaspora, I believe is what they call it, right when the Babylonians, a really short kind of like party boy empire comes over, messes everything up, and you have a bunch of generations of individuals who have a kind of culture and history of a place that they did not necessarily originate. And I wondered to myself, well, is the kind of culture and story and narrative that are basically to become Judaism really what unites what are scattered Canaanites and identifies themselves as basically Jews? And I'm like, finding the answer to that question is surprisingly difficult. It's like you're not going to get a lot of people that are willing to challenge these assumptions about the genealogy and history of ancient Jews, because you're stepping on a lot of toes that people do not want you to step on. And I mean, I think, again, like, that's why I was saying history is one of those things where you probably, you know, religion is wrapped up in a person's self-identity. And that's why, you know, if you notice a lot of personal attacks, I'm like, well, a lot of them, again, are bound up with all of this personal identity that they've allowed to cloud their judgment and make poor assessments of history, add to the garbage pile. It's like, that's unfortunate. How do we excise that, right? How do you tell a person that they're biased and they're doing bad work without it being personal?
Well, I mean, sometimes you do have to say things like that. But at other times, if the person's been trained well, people ought to be able to have a conversation that goes something like this. Well, that's an interesting idea you've got there, John, but we've tested it and it just isn't supported by the evidence. I think we have to move on and find another hypothesis that fits the evidence a bit better. Now, there's no reason why John should take that personally, but sometimes he might. But that's how science progresses.
Well, see, this is when I was trying to do some research on you, I went to ratemyprofessor.com to find out what people ranked you and their reviews. I don't know if you know that this exists.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Well, you'll be happy to know that your score is actually quite good, only marred by the dissatisfaction of some online course that skewed the data. Because otherwise, when you look at people's reaction to you, it was so flattering that I'm not even going to read them. Because you would be embarrassed by how flattering these reviews are, saying how nice you are.
Yeah, I haven't looked at those. Well, the online course is a general education course, and students tend to think that general education courses ought to be blow-off courses, and this one is not. And so it's regarded as too hard by some fraction of the students. You know, when I ask them the question, do you think this course was too hard this semester? Most of them will say no, they don't think it was too hard. But some do, and it's because of the attitude towards general education courses.
Well, you also have to remember that the internet has a higher proportion of haters than regular life.
Yeah, possibly.
It's just the hater effect. It's fine. There are some people out there. You could have the most brilliant video, for instance, on YouTube, and you'll still get dislikes. Somebody will be like, I don't like it because I didn't come up with it. It's probably their attitude. I don't know. There will always be people that would even fight a utopia. They would just say, I don't like it. And meanwhile, you got to be like, well, too fucking bad. The rest of us really, really do. And I don't want to get tyranny of the majority here. But sometimes you just have to not listen to haters. But here's what I found that was also interesting. In the reviews, they seem to mention a very attractive belt buckle that's quite prominent. Is this a thing? Is this right?
Well, yeah, I have a Navajo Mexican coin silver belt buckle that I've been wearing for years, and the students who take the courses where they actually see me and know that I'm a human being see that belt buckle frequently.
It's a trademark. It's good.
I could tell you a little story if you've got the time about that.
Oh, we've got the time for a belt buckle story.
I've been teaching for the last several years a course on forensic archaeology where I teach students how to use archaeological field techniques to solve forensic problems, because we have a forensics program here at Penn State, and this is my contribution to that. And we keep this course down to about 30 students because they have to work in teams, they have to do things outdoors, there's a lot of hands-on effort that goes into this one. Well, one of the things that we do is we have a fake murder victim that gets dug up every year, and the students have to figure out the evidence that is found with the fake murder victim. And then they have to design a new murder scenario and rebury the murder victim with a new set of evidence for next year's class to dig up.
That sounds like so much fun. Holy cow.
So it's great fun, and I have really enjoyed the course. But I am retiring this year, so I taught the course for the last time in the fall semester.
Oh, my goodness, that's so sad.
And the students decided that the murder victim this year should be me. And I hope that nobody that's going to sign up for this course is listening to this broadcast, because it'll ruin it for them. But they wanted me to provide some of my old clothing and other evidence, so that an old pair of glasses, so that the students next year could make inferences about who it was and figure out that it was me. And they wanted the belt buckle. And I said, not going to happen.
Oh, no.
You can have an old belt, but you can't have that Navajo belt buckle. So.
Yeah, you're just going to have to get someone to make a replica of that or something. If they're serious about it, they can put some effort, make a replica. There you go.
Yeah.
Now, the final question I want to ask you before we go, a sort of like, I guess it's a bit of a catch-all a question. And it goes back to the Confederacy that we were talking about for this great peacemaker. And I noticed, and I know this is not universal, but in their social structure, in part of their new design, part of their new constitution, gave a much different role to women. And a kind of interesting role. And I'm curious about it because, again, I've probably heard much of the mythologized versions of it, and I'm much more interested in what was it really like, because that for me would have been the interesting experience that I would have loved to see play out. If would have this caught on, and would this have probably quickened the civilizing factor of giving women a much more prominent role in society?
Well, I mean, this is one of the touchstones of Iroquois culture, and it goes, you have to go way back to see it, find its roots. It turns out that organizing a village or a household around the women, as opposed to around the men, is something that occurs worldwide in situations where migration is going on. And the Iroquois, because of the nature of their agriculture and the nature of their settlement, moved their villages frequently. So they were habitual migrants, I suppose. Now, often these villages only moved a few kilometers in order to get closer to the current fields that were being cultivated. But without animal domesticates, they didn't have manure that would allow them to keep using the same fields year after year, decade after decade. And they would have to relocate, clear new forest to find new soil that hadn't been depleted. That's why the villages move so frequently. And sometimes in the face of hostility with other groups, they might move a considerable distance. They might move the village, I don't care, 100 kilometers or 200 kilometers even, in order to get away from a bad situation politically. But when they do that, when a village relocates, that's an opportunity for the women to become the sort of the focus of the organization of the new village. So the longhouses were designed to take care of women and the families of closely related women. So a mom, a bunch of daughters, some aunts, those were the principal figures in a longhouse. And the in-marrying husbands and the children would fill out the longhouse population. So now you've got a village which is made up of longhouses that are mostly female-dominated. They're matrilocal. And the village itself, then, is governed by representatives coming from what are female-oriented units within it. And so it's the women who do the appointing. Now, the chiefs may be men, but they're appointed by the women. That was then stepped up to the Confederacy level and became the model that they used for holding the whole Haudenosaunee League together after it formed. So the central role of the women got replicated at that higher level when the league was formed. The beauty of having women running things is that it breaks up those fraternal groups that might otherwise fight with each other. So,
right. That's what I was saying. Like this development would seem to maybe speed up the rate in which, a civilized group becomes less violent, less prone to, male patterned aggression.
Well, it could certainly within the boundaries of whatever the political unit is, the maximum political unit is that they've got there. But even after that had evolved and emerged, the Iroquois remained a very potent military force in this part of the world, and these guys were intrepid warriors, and so. I mean, you could make the argument that women had managed to keep the peace within the village and within the Confederacy, but all they did was, help redirect all that violence to the external world. It's an interesting phenomenon. It'd be interesting to have seen what would have happened farther down the line if it all hadn't been interrupted by the European invasion.
I suppose what you would have to do, though, because here's the thing. Yes, if the group changes and all of a sudden there is more of a in-groupness amongst a confederacy, but naturally that creates out-groupness and probably leads to conflict. I think, though, that what you have to do, and this is what partially Steven Pinker was doing in his book, is look at, well, what are the instances in which a person will be killed at the hands of another human being? Because even in war, like conflicts of the 20th century, which we consider very bloody, very small percentage of the male population was facing death at the hands of other human beings, even though we just have this notion of these battles being so brutal. Battles themselves may be, but it's always a question of numbers, right, at the end of the day. And I suppose what you could look at is, well, what are the comparisons in terms of these violent death rates with the hunter-gatherer societies north of the Great Lakes and the more sort of sedentary, quote-unquote, civilized agricultural societies. So, I mean, I suppose the numbers are doable, but it would probably require years and years and years. Who's up for it? Who's up for it?
Well, there are some people that are doing this, and the whole business of the tracking the archaeology of warfare has become much interest in recent years. 20, 30 years ago or more, there were still a lot of people around that wanted to claim that war was a foreign notion to the American Indians, but they were as violent towards each other as they were to Europeans and vice versa after first contact. So this was not a phenomenon that didn't occur until after Columbus arrived. There was a lot of violence everywhere in the world before that.
The myth of the noble savage is just as irritating as the reverse, where all of a sudden it's like, oh no, they're nothing but warlike, a savage race. You're just like, both are wrong. this is not a vision of humanity. And I think that's ultimately what we should find when we discover and scratch the surface is just really all of our similarities. It's striking. It's just all the same. It just plays out. In fact, I think you can make predictions. And that's what I think that if we were to predict our own futures, I think that at least we have a lot to look forward to. Because despite the fact that things are definitely not perfect, our callousness at the death of people who starve to death while we, stuff our own faces would probably be viewed in future generations as a true monstrosity. And we have to work at improving that. But, I mean, I think that comes from us, right? We're the ones who have to sort of like face the challenges of creating the society of the future. And part of that means that, we have to accept and look at ourselves really, really harshly, continue to do that. But we have so far, I think we're slowly getting there. And, thanks to the works of people like you, Dean.
Well, thanks, Jake. It's been a lot of fun talking to you today, and look forward to hearing from you again.
Well, we're definitely going to have a follow-up. Now, before we go, is there a book that perhaps you could recommend of the ones you've written that would be accessible to people that perhaps they should check out? Is there anything that you could recommend?
Well, having to do with the Iroquois, I've got a book out called The Iroquois.
All right, well, that's going to be in the notes. So they'll be able to link to it. I'll also put it on the site. And this is the main thesis of the book is?
Well, this is just a kind of a history of the Iroquois from from their first arrival in the Northeast up to the day before yesterday, from an archaeological perspective mostly. And I published this back in about 95. So it's been a steady seller ever since.
Well, hopefully there's lots of people listening to the show now that are curious about that and be like, hey, if you're from North America, know your damn history.
Yeah.
All right, Dean, thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, Jake.